This morning we're going to be continuing our Thin Places series, looking at times and places where God has revealed himself to his people, where the divide between heaven and earth becomes thin. And as part of this, we've been asking, what does it look like to be a thin place people? Not bound by any specific time or places, but to be a people who leave room in their lives to be with Jesus and to be in his presence like we've been this morning. And this morning, I want to look at the story of Elijah. It's a story that God has been using to speak to me recently, and one where we typically skip some of the other important parts of the story that I think can help reveal some of God's character to us this morning. And it also kind of follows the same blueprint of Moses ascending Mount Sinai, so that John was actually unpacking at the beginning of this series. So it's a bit of an echo and a bit of a similar story that we can dive into. But first, can I set the scene this morning? Bear with me as I kind of set the scene for those that may not be aware of the whole story. I think it helps kind of give us some context and some background. My kind of Old Testament knowledge is not particularly like fantastic, and so it helps me to kind of set the context by which we enter the story. And so at the beginning, we have the 12 tribes of Israel arriving in the Promised Land. And for a while, they lived comfortably in their inheritance, lived within the covenant that God had established for them. But this ultimately didn't last very long because they started looking at the nations around them and start to worship their gods and their false idols. Things that they could see and touch on the walls, rituals and sacrifices that built up their own, built themselves up rather than was true worship to God, and became a people who followed their own rules versus the covenant that they had agreed with God. This obviously displeased God, and so as part of their disobedience, he gave part of their lands into their enemies' hands, effectively let them be conquered and be ruled by these foreign nations. And they said, if you want to go and worship these gods, go ahead, but be prepared to be ruled by these enemies who detest you so much. But God, true to his promises, continues to defend his people in Israel. And to do this, he raises up a series of judges to lead the people, kind of warrior prophets who are become regional tribal leaders God's appoints for a specific time and purpose. And these judges are a bit of a mixed bag. Some mainly stay true to God. They try and maybe hedge their bets a bit with a bit of idol worship on the side just in case. But a number of these are still very, very wicked people. They already have deep issues because they look like the people that they're being called out of. People who, despite being called from God, they choose to worship other gods and eventually lead Israel astray. Lots of these judges meet kind of very bloody ends in quite dire circumstances. And eventually the kind of Israelites get a bit bored of this, and they start to look around at these other nations around them and look, see that they've all got rulers and kings, and they kind of demand a king for themselves. Kind of reminds me of the sort of the schoolyards. You know, Fred's mum lets him stay out late. Why can't I stay out late? You know, Sally's got new trainers. Why can't I have new trainers? It's kind of looking around and seeing, oh, I want a bit of that. And in the prophet Samuel then warns the Israelites, if you get a king, they're going to rule over you. The idea previously that God was their king, that they put God in charge of their lives. They look to him to rule over them and to look after them. But if you choose a king, you're subject to their whims and desires that they have. And this backfires for Israel. They get some good kings, like David, who, despite his flaws and mistakes, was recorded as one who pursued God's heart, that was looking to be with God and to do the things that God wanted him to do. They got a lot of bad kings, those who turned away from God and adopted other gods to worship. It got so bad that all this turmoil, battles and infighting, that one of the tribes of Israel, Judah, split off from the rest of the kingdom and installed its own king as this one nation suddenly becomes two. This is where we kind of enter the story. So we have King Ahab, the king of Israel in the northern region, so not including Judah. And we read that he was the worst king that Israel had ever had. He effectively banned the worshipping of God, and established the worship of Baal as the national religion. He also married Jezebel, one of the daughters of a foreign king, who imported this new religion, and the prophets, and she had the prophets of God put to death. So in my like research and reading for this morning, I've been trying to do my due diligence. I'm terrible at pronouncing things in the Old Testament. So I'm going to be giving things a go this morning. But I've actually learned the proper way to say Baal is Baal or something to that extent. But I've been saying Baal for all my life. So it's going to be tricky to switch. I'm just going to be a stubborn Englishman and just say Baal for the rest of this, if that's okay. But if you want to impress anyone when you're reading, you can say Baal, or something like that. Thank you. So in comes Elijah, a prophet of God, and he declares, because of Ahab's wicked ways and how he's been leading Israel, he declares a drought on the land, no rain for 3.5 years, effectively causing a famine for all the people. God looks after Elijah during this time, calling ravens to bring him food, keeping him by a source of water until it eventually dries up too, and then miraculously keeping a flour jar and oil jug full as he stays with a widow and her son, ultimately keeping Elijah safe as Ahab and Jezebel look to try and kill him during this drought. At the end of 3 years, it all comes to a head at the famous standoff at Mount Carmel, Elijah versus the prophets of Baal. Both set up sacrifices on altars to their God, but they wait to see which God provides the fire. The prophets of Baal try really hard to get their God's attention, screaming, wailing, self-harming, but nothing happens. But when Elijah prays, after dousing his sacrifice with precious water, God burns the sacrifice, evaporating all of the water and demonstrating that he is God. And now we pick up the story now in 1 Kings chapter 19. I'll be reading from the CSB. Ahab told Jezebel everything that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "May the gods punish me and do so severely if I don't make your life like the one of like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then Elijah became afraid and immediately ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba, that belonged to Judah, he left his servant there. But he went on a day's journey into the wilderness. He sat down under a broom tree and prayed that he might die. He said, "I've had enough. Lord, take my life, for I'm no better than my ancestors." Then he lay down and slept under the broom tree. Suddenly, an angel touched him. The angel told him, "Get up and eat." Then he looked, and there at his head was a loaf of bread baked over hot stones and a jug of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. Then the angel of the Lord returned for a second time and touched him. He said, "Get up and eat, for the journey will be too much for you." So he got up, ate and drank. Then on the strength from that food, he walked 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. He entered a cave there and spent the night. I think this is the kind of part of the story that I think we forget after this fantastic mountaintop encounter where God demonstrate his glory in a magnificent way. We can kind of find ourselves often in these situations, following high moments in our lives where we feel like God has moved powerfully, where we've felt God's power and his presence tangibly, or where we've seen him demonstrably move in our lives. Maybe you've spent some time away with God, or a retreat or conference. You're with lots of other followers of Jesus. You're really encouraged and enthused. And the space that you've been inhabiting feels different when you're with those that also follow Jesus. I know this feeling really well, as I can remember summer after summer coming back from Soul Survivor, which was a youth festival that I attended as a teenager. Coming back filled with the Holy Spirit, but ultimately being disappointed that this closeness, that sense of God's presence, didn't always travel back with me and to those around me. Also, coming back to a church that hadn't experienced the same things that we had experienced was quite tricky for us as a youth group. This is a really good time to remember for us to give space for our young people as they prepare to go to Limitless Festival. When they come back, that we can give them space to share what they've experienced, how God has impacted their lives, and to be led by them to a certain degree into God's presence. But when we come back from those mountaintop situations, those encounters, there's always a bit of dissatisfaction there. We don't always see the result we wanted, where God hasn't totally removed the obstacle in our path. Or we're met with a new set of challenges when we come back into the reality of life and the day-to-day living. When we find ourselves in those situations, we often feel alone. Going into secular workplaces or into schools feels like sometimes in those areas we're the only followers of Jesus in those contexts. Here is where we find Elijah. He's just performed a series of reality-defying miracles that the Israelites hadn't seen since Moses. And after this great encounter, we find him alone, depressed, anxious, and suicidal. I think a lot of the time we kind of forget that these prophets and these great people reading the Bible were people too, just like us. We kind of put this persona on them as almost superheroes. And I think we often kind of gloss over the weight of the task put upon them when we read these stories. And so here Elijah being, pushing against the established ruler of the time, and he's had to declare a drought and subsequent famine. And he still has to live in that world where this is going on. But he's the one who's prophesied this, who's brought this into being. And I feel like the novelty of being fed by ravens would probably wear off quite quickly, being in that space. He's had to live amongst people starving, and he's had to live with a widow and her son who were planning to die before he provide that miraculous source of flour and oil. And suddenly, this job that he, from the mountaintop experience, looks like a job too big, a responsibility too big. He's made big enemies with lots of resources that want him dead. I think this is a pretty natural reaction, being faced with all this that he has come to. I think it's pretty justified to go and run away from that, to go and run away from that situation, from those people trying to get him, to go back into hiding, to get to safety. But I just love, in this first instance, God's response to his faithful servant who has been through it all and lost his nerve. God provides rest and nourishment. And this fundamental focus on the basics by God, who cares for our basic needs and provides for us just when we need it. I think this reveals a character of God who doesn't skip the small stuff. He knows us deeply. He knows how our bodies work, and he provides all we need just when we need it. I think especially when the task is big, when we're in a context or a workplace that is maybe particularly feels oppressive at times, or you're seeing just the fallen nature of the world very, very demonstrably. Or when the vision is big, we have quite a big vision here at OCC. We're trying to live quite radically. We're trying to organize differently to focus on lives that reflect Jesus as we go out into our communities through our missional households. And I can feel that we kind of miss the part that God wants to continue to sustain us and give us rest during that time. He wants to sustain us for the long haul, for the vision. I think sometimes this simple act of slowing down, stopping, resting and eating has a powerful effect, because it quite radically changes Elijah's journey from running away from something to running towards God as he ascends the Mount of the Lord, as it says. I think if we're to be a thin place people, we need to learn this pattern. When we're burned out, afraid of the task before us, or feeling alone, that we direct our attentions towards God. And we need to do that. I think we need to build in these times of rest and nourishment to do the same. to turn our running away from a bad week, the building crisis at work, the difficult times where the kids weren't listening to you, to take time out and to say to God, I need you. Because we worship a God that has so much more. There's more of God available to us. He doesn't run out, just like that flour and jug of oil didn't run out. Just as I had a word from God last week when I said, he's waiting on us. We're not waiting on him. He's waiting on us to approach him. He's always there, ready for us. We can't catch him unaware. And I think Elijah knows there's more of God available to him, and he knows where to go. Because the other name for Mount Horeb, for most scholars, is Mount Sinai. The same mountain that God met Moses to give him the Ten Commandments. The same mountain where God spent time with Moses and held Moses into the cleft of the rock as he walked past him, only letting him see his back as he passed by. And there's a bit of debate, depending on who you ask, specifically where Mount Sinai is. But where most people think it is, it's about 11 days' journey away for someone in that time period, based on what Elijah had in terms of sandals and the rocky terrain. But it takes around 40 days. It takes 40 days for him to get there, 40 nights. The same number of days that Moses fasted with God on top of the mountain, and the same number that Jesus fasted in the desert. I won't get too much into the numerology of this morning, but our assumption based on this is that after having the bread that God provided for him, he fasted along his journey, taking it slow, resting and preparing himself for his communion with God on top of the mountain. A few months ago, I had the deep pleasure of going with John and Ian to ELS, Elam Leaders Summit, which is the main annual conference for our movement, Elam. We're in Elam Church here. And it was just a fantastic time of worship, of teaching, of doing the more practical stuff of the business session as part of our movement. I was the kind of the lay representative from our church here, kind of voting on things, speaking with other churches, and effectively establishing the direction of the movement. And it was a fantastic time of worship, of teaching, but I had one problem. I hadn't really effectively managed my workload and properly booked the time off with work. I had a bit of flexibility with my job at the time, but I still had to finish off a few projects and respond to any queries that people were coming in my way. And this, ahead of it, I didn't think this was going to be a problem. I just, do a few bits in the evening. But the issue was, work was on my mind as I was trying to worship, as I was trying to concentrate on God. Something would always be in the back of the mind, this anxiety that someone was trying to reach me and I was unavailable. Until I got until we finished the business session on the first day, and I got this message on Slack saying that I was just laid off from my job, which was good timing. I definitely did not have any barriers to concentrate on God then in that moment. So after telling Jess and working out what I wanted to do next, I prayed. I thanked God for what he had next for me. I was confident that he had something next. There was something, a job out there for me. But I prayed specifically for resilience during this period, this job search and endless application and rejection and just navigating that period of my life. I continued to put my trust in him to help me through this next period, which I wasn't particularly looking forward to. And I felt quite a strong sense that God was saying, actually, this time is a gift to you, which took me entirely by surprise. I wasn't looking forward to this time, wasn't looking forward to the job hunt, but I felt it was just God saying, this time is a gift. And I have to say, it has really been a gift. I start a new job on Tuesday, and it's actually been around 40 weekdays that I've had off over this period. God has been really, really good. But I haven't done so well over those 40 days. I can probably count one day out of the 40 where I've properly rested in God fully and kind of taken that gift. But maybe that's what it took. Maybe God just gave me those 40 days just for that one day. For me, I'm hardwired for productivity, for getting things done, checking things off the list, getting to inbox zero. And for me, switching off is an incredibly difficult task. And I just wonder what God sometimes has to arrange when we're so focused on work, we're so focused on getting things done, on doing the to-do list, what he has to do to actually get our attention. What happens so we actually can rest in him? What he has to do so we actually prepare ourselves to spend time with God over that period. Let's continue the story of Elijah. So this is from verse 9. Suddenly, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He replied, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of armies. But the Israelites have abandoned your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they're looking for me to take my life." Then he said, "Go out and stand on the mountain in the Lord's presence." At that moment, the Lord passed by. A great and mighty wind was tearing at the mountains and were shattering cliffs before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, there was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, there was a voice, a soft whisper. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Suddenly a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" "I've been very zealous for the Lord God of armies," he replied. "But the Israelites have abandoned your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they're looking for me to take my life." Then the Lord said to him, "Go and return by the way you came to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, you are to anoint Hazael as king over Aram. You are to appoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And Elisha, son of Snapchat, we'll say, from Abel-Meloah as prophet in your place. And then Jehu will put together whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death whoever escapes the sword of Jehu. But I will leave 7,000 in Israel. Every knee that has not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." I just love the way that God so tenderly looks after Elijah in this moment. After his long journey, Elijah's long journey, God asks him, "What are you doing here?" There's a tenderness to God's response. He knows why Elijah's here, but he still gives him his opportunity to get his burdens off his chest. And Elijah's response is honest from his own point of view. It's how he's feeling. But he's inaccurate in saying that he alone was left. Kind of reflects his state of mind. He feels alone. He feels outnumbered with a task he alone is bearing. But he's wrong. He was just told by Obadiah, a faithful servant of God who was in charge of Ahab's palace, that he had personally hidden 100 prophets true to the Lord and kept them fed and watered during this famine. And God says later on that there are 7,000 left in the kingdom that have not bowed down to Baal. I think sometimes we can be in that same situation when we're feeling alone as part of those encounters. When we enter the world, we're feeling alone, and actually God is actually putting people to our left and our right. Sometimes we don't see them. Sometimes we don't know that they're there yet. But in those moments, we can actually feel alone. And I feel this kind of reflects where Elijah is in this moment. And God invites him to invites Elijah to experience his presence in a way that's very, very similar to how Moses got to see him on that same mountain. And we get this dramatic scene of wind an earthquake and then a fire. And it's a very odd statement, a very specific statement, that God was not in those signs. Until God, and suddenly, God is there, beckoning Elijah out from the cave with a soft whisper. Other different translations use a gentle breeze. Or my favorite translation says, the sound of sheer silence. And just imagine, after all of those signs being quite scary, actually, if the mountainside is crumbling before you, and then this raging fire all of a sudden, the ground is shaking, and suddenly there is just nothing. This is the same God who we saw at Mount Carmel, who demonstrated his glory in a magnificent and all-consuming way. The Almighty, the All-Powerful. But he chooses to inhabit the silence, to draw us closer, to make him approachable. Without God holding back, pushing our face in the rock as he passed by, we can't experience him. We can't see his face. Even Elijah has to wrap his face in his cloak as he goes out there because of the just enormousness of God's glory, the size of his glory. On this mountaintop, Elijah needed a personal encounter with the Lord to experience his presence, just like Moses before him, who was equally kind of weighed down with the burden of leading the Israelites at that time. God meets him in the thin place in a new way, a deeper, more intimate way that I don't think Elijah had experienced previously. And God again asks him, why are you here? Teasing out the state of Elijah's heart. And still, Elijah answers the same. And I think this next part is particularly wonderful in that God recommissions him, giving him a friend and a successor in Elisha to share the burden and to end part of that loneliness that he was experiencing. He also tasks him with appointing a new king of Israel and a new king of one of the enemies of Israel who were keeping Israel in check at that moment, giving Elijah a hope that his enemies would be defeated. And he finally reminds Elijah that there are still the people out there worshipping the true God who had not worshipped Baal. And there were people there left fighting for to see God return as the one being worshipped. I think there's actually this kind of pattern that we see. There's actually quite a natural cadence in our life. This pattern of rest, communion with God, and recommissioning for what he has ahead of us, because the job's still not done. And we see this in our lives as part of the Sabbath, which is it's one of our values here at OCC, where we try and give God a portion of time, sort of 24 hours out of the week, where we switch our attention away from work, and we push our attention to God, all of his goodness. This doesn't need to be a Sunday. We're not religious about the Sabbath. It's definitely not us locking ourselves away from the world for 24 hours. I've got kids, probably wouldn't be able to do that. I don't think Jess would be happy if I'm saying, I'm having my Sabbath now, please don't disturb me. But what it does look like is intentionally worshiping God and resting, enduring the good things he has given us, good food, good company, a beautiful world to enjoy, a football team who are going to be champions of Europe at 10 p.m. this evening. But it's also giving us time to focus on him, establishing God as a king of our lives and leaning on him for his provision. And I think that's important, isn't it? It's making sure that we do something in that time that actually gives us true rest. And I think there is something about encountering God and spending time with God that gives us rest. But also, in whatever we're doing, we choose things that actually restore us. There's times where, as part of this, I've tried to be hospitable and have people around, and I've created a very elaborate meal. And at the end of it, I'm actually not very rested because I'm stressed. I've got a million pots and pans on the burner. I've got things in the oven. And actually, it's not actually very restful for me. When actually, person coming around will probably be happy with some beans on toast. So actually, when we come into thinking and planning through our Sabbath rest, yes, let's spend time together. Yes, let's enjoy it, but let's make sure it's restful. I think a lot of the time, rest in the modern world is kind of consuming entertainment. It's kind of sitting down, going through Netflix. And even that sometimes is not probably the best in terms of actually giving us true rest. During that time, it does give space to be with God. And whatever form that works for you, another one of our values is creativity, in one of our up values in terms of loving Jesus and spending time with him. That could be listening to music, spending time painting, going out for a walk, and enjoying what God has provided for us. But I think that's also, that time with Jesus is especially important because that's typically when God wants to recommission us week by week, giving us a fresh sense of what he's doing in us and through us as he works behind the scenes to build his kingdom here. There's a natural rhythm given by God to us in terms of this 24 hours out of 7 days. And I think it's quite silly for us to ignore it. It's something that over this time period, I've been trying to be looking forward to expectantly. I'm not saying I don't have to shut myself away, but I can have some time with God purposefully, and he can continue to work in me during that time. However, we've actually tried to ignore it this week to our peril. So I'm starting this new job on Tuesday. Unfortunately, we had a funeral to go to on Friday, which left this Thursday just gone, as my last day with the kids being off from work. They're in nursery Monday to Wednesday. And so I pushed and said, let's go to the think tank in Birmingham, which is a huge play museum. It's fantastic, right on the top floor. It's called Mini Brum. It's got like miniature versions of famous Birmingham landmarks and things to play, and it's absolutely fantastic. I thought this is going to be a great day out. It's our last day. The only issue was the aforementioned nursery on Monday to Wednesday, and so by Thursday our kids are absolutely knackered. They are very, very difficult to try and be pliable and to get them out of the house. And so usually on Thursday they stay home, or at least home in the afternoon to take extra naps. And so Thursday was us contending with two very tired children, trying to drag them around Birmingham on the train. In the end, it wasn't too bad, but I could see how that desire for me to create memories ignored their actual need for rest in that moment. And kind of looking at my own life, and actually what I'm trying to achieve, what I'm trying to build in my own strength, kind of leads me against the rest that I need in those situations. It's been wonderful to see Oscar recently being passed around different members of the church. Very appreciative, by the way. He's currently trying to escape out the building. But it's always funny to see him like falling asleep on people. There's something restorative with kids about resting in someone else's arms. And I think there's a real lesson there for us. Because if we go to God as we're told to, like children, we get to rest in his presence, in his arms, and we get to be honest with him about what we're going through, just as Elijah was. We get to spend time with him and learn more about his plan for the restoration of all things. It says in Matthew 11, Jesus says, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, because I am lowly and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Reminded also to come to Jesus as little children, totally trusting in him, putting all of our cares onto him, and being surrounded by his arms. Because in Jesus, we have a king who is both holy and sovereign, but is also a person who has experienced every pain, every emotion. This is what the Israelites were crying out for as they're looking to establish a king. They wanted someone who they could see and touch. And now we have it. We can boldly approach the throne of God thanks to Jesus, and we get to spend time with him. When we take that time out as part of our weeks, we get to see what God is doing in our lives. Kind of get that zoomed out picture when we stop kind of toiling, stop expending energy to get things done, actually see what God is doing, because he can do a lot more than we can. And he sometimes lets us know, he might not always be as clear to us what he's doing as he was to Elijah, but he's always at work, and there's always a lot of stuff that he's doing that we don't know about and we may never know about. Oh, he's fallen into the bucket. As we get to spend those time with Jesus, we get to re-trust him with the stuff that we don't know. I think that's important. Just as a child goes and trusts, you know, if Phoebe hurts herself, she trusts me that I can kiss it better and put some cream on it, whatever it is, and it will get better. And we can do that same thing with God. We can trust him. So actually, your way is best. You know what's best for us. But also, as we gather weekly in our missional households and on Sundays here, we're also reminded that we're not alone. We're here, we're together with our brothers and sisters in Christ to support one another, to pray for one another, and to join one another in those places and times where we feel outnumbered in the world. Do you want to text John? And that's why it's really important to continue to meet together in whatever form you can make, whether it's on Sunday, whether it's part of a missional household. If you're not part of a missional household and you want to get involved, come and speak to me afterwards. It's important that we see the work that God is doing in each of our lives and remind us that we're not alone. Going to be taking communion in a few moments just to spend some time, more time with Jesus. But I want to do it a bit differently today. So I was actually up this morning quite early, and I've actually, Victor, can you put the picture up? I took a lovely picture this morning. So I was actually making some bread as they expect how they typically made bread at the time. Which was baked over some hot stones on my barbecue. The stones were, in fact, old slabs from the garden. So it might be a nice earthy taste this morning. There is some gluten-free bread if you would prefer something that I haven't cooked. But I just wanted us just to spend some time this morning just reflecting on Elijah's journey. And just that kind of story. Oh, there it is. See, there, I had three people come downstairs this morning looking at me strangely as I was barbecuing something at 8 a.m. 7:30, sorry. There's lots of excitement as well, though. It's quite exciting time. I just wanted us to reflect on that journey of Elijah, that initial place of rest and nourishment, God giving him the food that he needed. And that time, just that time of sleeping as well. I think it's wonderful that he just slept and let God look after him in that moment. Forward to that time of preparation, that journey, that taking 40 days to get to the mountain. The expectation that Elijah had, the fact that he knew he could go on this journey and he would meet with God. And then ultimately that mountaintop encounter, that time of visibly being in God's presence, the tangible nature, the hearing of the sound of God's almighty power in the wind, the ground breaking beneath him, and the fire as it ripped through the air. And just that time of recommissioning in terms of actually here's everything that I'm doing for you behind the scenes that you don't know about. So let's just spend some time. If you could, everyone could close your eyes. I just want to for you to imagine just for a moment that you are sleeping under a big tree. It's giving you much needed shade from the midday sun. And you're running away from something. Maybe just take a few moments just to name what that thing that you are running away from internally, just to yourself. Maybe it's a situation at work. Maybe it's something at home. Some internal anxiety for something that's coming up this week. Suddenly you hear a voice, get up and eat, or the journey will be too much for you. You see freshly baked bread, and you can smell it. Just to take a moment, just to imagine what that bread looks like for you. After this time of resting, you know that you need to go to see God. You need to spend some time with God. Where are you going? Where is the thin place in your own life? Where are you drawn to? Where are you journeying to? Just spend a few moments just thinking about that thin place in your life. Maybe it's a room in your house. Maybe it's a particular walk that you go on, or it's a favorite chair. Maybe it's something that reminds you of what God's done for you. Some time passes. You've been on the journey for a long time. You hear a familiar voice. What are you doing here? In your own heart this morning, try to answer honestly. What are you running from? What do you say to the voice at this time? The voice invites you to look out from the safe place that you found yourself in. You hear a great and powerful wind. The wind dies down, but then you are shaking, feeling the ceiling is going to come down on you. And you hear this distinctive roar of the fire ripping through the air. And finally, a deafening silence. Something pierces through the silence, a quiet whisper. What are you doing here? Does your answer change? Can you begin to see some of the inaccuracies you said when the voice asked you before? The voice commissions you. Where are they asking you to go? And who can go with you on the journey? Just spend a few moments just reflecting on that. We're just going to finish this morning by just taking communion with one another. And just as you take the communion this morning, so you just remember what Jesus has done for us as we find perfect rest in him, as we have access to God's presence through him, as he provides what we need in the right moment. Just reflect on what you've brought to God this morning and just give that to him.